Welcome back to another edition of The Week in Blog here on bloggingheads.tv. My faithful partner, Matt Lewis, is not in this week, but we have a great guest in his stead, Kristen Soltis. Thanks for being on Blogging Heads.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you tell the folks a little bit about yourself?
So I am the Director of Policy and Strategic Research at the Winston Group. Basically, I'm a pollster. I do survey research work, and I do a little bit of – I write for pollster.com, and I put together a sort of podcast of my own called The Right Idea.
And where can you find The Right Idea?
Well, if you go to winstongroup.net, you can find all the information there. Also, there's kristensoltis.com where – you know, the nice little self-promotion hub online where you can go find it.
Excellent. And for those who don't know, I'm Bill Scher with Campaign for America's Future at ourfuture.org. I've also blogged at liberaloasis.com for what seems like forever, and my own podcast is there, the Liberal Oasis Radio Show. But on to the Week in Blog festivities. Certainly the biggest chatter in the liberal blogosphere this week was the slap that the quote-unquote professional left got from White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs in an interview with The Hill, saying that some on the left won't give Obama credit no matter what. They think he's like George Bush. They should be drug tested. This seemed tailor-made to get liberal bloggers up in arms.
Mm-hmm.
My own boss, Robert Borisaj, at a very popular post, said Gibbs and the left, dog bites the man, where he lists six reasons why, quote, Gibbs' outburst doesn't make much sense, that number one, the left was right, and that the president's in trouble because his reforms were too timid, not too bold. The left was wrong, not because it was too independent, because it was too cooperative and accepting too many of these compromises, so on and so forth. Certainly other takes include now I'm fumbling to find one. Excuse me about that. Here's a Atrios over at Eschaton. After Gibbs tried to walk it back by saying, "I watch which cable I admit," and then cited a conservative criticism, and Atrios said, "So frustration at right-wing a-holes on cable news makes you lash out the professional left who are busy trying to get the teacher funding passed. I don't even know what this is supposed to mean."
Also that I noticed that, like, Glenn Greenwald, he had a big long piece about this, and I noticed people, my friends who are on the left, were tweeting this statement that the right fears, or that Republican politicians fear their base, but the Democratic politicians hate their base.
And was that David Frum who quoted that?
I actually don't know if it was David Frum who said that. For some reason, it was something that was getting retweeted by a lot of my friends who are on the left. I would somewhat disagree with the notion that all Republican politicians fear the base. I thought it was. I do think that the dynamic between Republicans and their base is very different than, or at least this Robert Gibbs thing was very illuminating to me as someone who's an outsider. I don't understand the relationship between the White House and the left, except I know there's been a lot of sort of frustration over the size of the stimulus, the public option, et cetera. You know, has this been the dream administration that a lot of folks on the left thought it would be?
I'm happy to try to illuminate.
I would love, yes, please.
Well, I think, and I've forgive me if I'm repeating myself from past episodes, but the left is very split on Obama, and that might not be obvious to folks who are not, in the soup every day, but they're definitely, I'm speaking more broadly beyond the bloggers for now, but just sort mm-hmm. of the left of center America in general. There are certainly folks that are diehard Obama, who feel he's doing his 100% against, entrenched special interest and a difficult system. And there are folks on the left who feel Obama has been timid and doesn't fight hard enough and is too quick to take compromises, doesn't fight for the big things. There's even been some scuttlebutt that is actively antagonistic towards some of the left in Washington, and that sort of flared up with the Gibbs comment there. And what is more notable in the blogosphere. Certainly, I think the more higher trafficked and louder voices in the blogosphere are the ones who are the most critical. And in many cases, these were the folks that weren't really on the Obama bandwagon in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Some people assume that Obama had the entire online left in his thrall from the get-go, and that really wasn't the case. And this is something that was further illuminated by Ben Smith at Politico, who right after Gibbs made his comment, said, Obama went into Iowa, for instance, with no major union support. After Iowa, everything changed. He inherited union support. He inherited John Edwards' liberal institutional support. He became the clear alternative to Hillary Clinton based on her past support for the Iraq War. But after Iowa, from the vantage point of Robert Gibbs and others who had begun 2 years earlier, was very late in the game. If you're with Obama before Iowa, you're making an investment. If either after Iowa, you were jumping on the bandwagon, you would still incur gratitude, but the risk you were taking just wasn't the same. And goes on to argue that from the Obama administration's perspective, or at least some within, that Obama did not rely on this part of the left to win the nomination, but effectively created their own infrastructure and their own online support. So you're getting from a lot of the liberal bloggers now, how dare you disrespect us when you need us as part of your coalition. As Peter Dow tweeted, there's not an understanding that these folks have disproportionate influence on the entire discourse.
Mm-hmm.
From the Obama administration perspective, at least according to Ben Smith, we got here without you in the first place, and we can throw you a dig and we'll get away with it.
One of the things that I noticed, it was on the Sunday shows a few months ago, is you had folks like Axelrod saying, you know, Democrats still have a really decent shot in the midterm elections because we're going to be able to rally our base. So it seemed to me at that point that, you know, courting the base, rallying the base, trying to bring them back was going to be a higher priority than trying to rally independents. And so that's why this shocked me completely, because I thought, you know, Democrats aren't doing very well among independents in a lot of polls. Aren't they really going to need their base to want to work with them and to be energized and enthused about them? I mean, the elections are coming up. That's why this sort of his comments just struck me as very ill-timed.
Well, that certainly was an argument that many bloggers are making, including, I'd say, honorary blogger Paul Krugman on his New York Times blog, that is just, you know, it's one thing to harbor these sentiments, another thing to publicly air them in an unprofessional way when you need every last bit of your coalition to get through these elections. But I do think, and this is not to say a defense of Gibbs, but I do think that it can be a misnomer what the Democratic base is. The progressive blogosphere is certainly a part of that, but it's not the entire thing. And this goes to the question of fearing your base or being angry at it.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible the Obama White House is saying, you know what? You don't think you know the base as well as you think you do, and we think we know the base better, and they'll be more enthusiastic by taking a slap at the critics and mm-hmm. getting our diehards up in arms. You don't know who has the best grasp of it until election day, but I certainly think that there's a lot of oversimplification of what the Democratic base really is.
Yeah, and it depends, too, if you think of it in more demographic terms or if you think of it in ideological terms. Like, if you think of the Democratic base as folks that are the furthest to the left, that's not necessarily encapsulated, you know. If you think of the base as the folks most likely to turn out all the time, I mean, you can have some conservative Democrats, but if they're members of a union, then they're relatively likely to turn out to vote every election. I mean, then they would, I would assume, be considered part of the base, even if they're not necessarily liberal. So I think it also just depends what it is you define as a party's base heading into an election.
Exactly. Moving on to, speaking of elections, we did have a few elections this past Tuesday. We had primaries in Colorado and Connecticut and Georgia and Minnesota. And the traditional media narrative was that this was a good day for Democrats. They picked, you know, Obama got his people through, and the Tea Partiers were able to get their favored people through at the expense of the favored candidates of the Republican establishment. And the, I would say, conventional wisdom was that these Tea Party candidates have a far less likelihood of winning statewide in states like Colorado, where these were states that were potential Republican pickups, and now the chances are diminished. I don't know if you'd call Linda McMahon in Connecticut a Tea Partier, but certainly her record as head of the World Wrestling.
Yeah, she's got some challenges ahead of her, for
right,
sure.
Right. she has challenges. Buck in Colorado has challenges. Mm-hmm. And now, there was, I think, differing takes within the liberal blogosphere on the subject. Some that were in track with, I think, that traditional media narrative. Tim Fernholz over at The American Prospect, saying the pattern of reactionary conservatives coming to the fore in Republican primaries is very real. It could cost Republicans the Senate next year, where it was once possible to imagine GOP victories in Nevada, Florida, Connecticut, and Colorado in particular. But then you have folks like David Diane, who's posted an article like you flagged for me, saying, look, the turnout for Colorado Dems is much lower than the turnout for Colorado Republicans. This is showing a real enthusiasm gap that could speak for trouble in November, and that goes back to the little Gibbs discussion. And you still have certain progressive bloggers out there, you know, waving that red flag, saying, hey, you're disrespecting us and not fighting hard enough. That's going to depress your base.
Mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, you've got bloggers on the right who, for instance, Red State, they weren't, Eric Erickson wasn't as thrilled about the outcome in the Georgia, the primary down there, Nathan Deal beating out Karen Handel. I mean, I think, for instance, let's look at Colorado, where with Ken Buck. I mean, there's going to be an enthusiasm gap, I believe, in November. But, you know, take a look at someone like Sharron Angle. The conventional wisdom is that she's too far right. She's the best gift that Harry Reid could have gotten. And yet, I think that it what matters is if these Tea Party candidates can figure out how to run in a general and how quickly they can get up to speed running in a general, rather than running as vote for me because I'm the most conservative. As soon as they can transition into becoming candidates, vote for me because I will help create jobs, you know, sort of changing that narrative. I think that's going to be the big thing that, you know, folks are hoping a lot of these Tea Party candidates can do successfully.
I mean, we have a certain, you know, test run with Sharron Angle here. I mean, she's had a fair amount of time since winning her primary victory. I would think most people say she really hasn't made that much of a pivot.
Well, I mean, she's got a new ad out now where she's talking about, she's talking about putting Social Security in a lockbox, actually. But, you know, it's I suppose I would expect to see candidates who came out of primaries. You know, I mean, she never really mentions the Tea Party. She never mentions, you know, I'm the true conservative, a conservative voice for, you know, it was a policy focused ad. It was a solutions focused ad. You can agree or disagree about the infamous Al Gore lockbox. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, I believe that she's very aware that her campaign as a Tea Party candidate is not enough to have her to bring about a victory in Nevada. So I think our campaign understands that.
There's an attempt to reach out to independence.
To the extent to which the pivot is successful, we still have a few months to see. But I think there are some efforts being made there that leave me optimistic about her chances.
Now, I saw, you know polls better than I do, I'm sure. I did see a poll, I think it was Reuters, that had Reid up over Angle by 16 amongst registered voters, but only up by 4 with likely voters. And I'm generally skeptical of likely voter models because they seem very arbitrary and definitely more art, not science.
Yeah.
But that would seem to speak to an enthusiasm gap.
It does. Well, I mean, it depends too. I always get very skeptical of likely voter screens just because you're introducing a pollster's subjective judgment about what they think the turnout model is going to be. I mean, I think that it's important for you to have that registered voter sample to refer back to. Because, you know, anything is possible. And we saw likely voter screens. That was a big reason why the New Hampshire primaries in 08, things looked a little odd heading into them. Or rather, when you looked at the polls and you looked at the results, things were very, very different. Other candidates probably would have been more competitive against Harry Reid. But I don't think that it's over. I think that Sharron Angle has a very good shot, again, if she's able to make that transition. And if the environment stays the way that it is. I mean, I think it's getting a little bit too late for unemployment to magically get better and things to turn around for Democrats. I don't know that Obama's job approval is going to change radically. I think you saw in Colorado that Bennett sort of shied away from the question of whether he wanted Obama to come campaign for him, which I think, interestingly, goes back to our first point that we were talking about the extent to which the Obama administration and even Democratic candidates in the field, you know, to what extent is their relationship going to be good this cycle?
Now, you mentioned briefly there was some consternation on the right regarding the Georgia primary outcome, which I don't think has gotten a lot of discussion. Quite frankly, I don't even understand, you know, what was the dispute between, is this Nathan Deal and Handel, is that right?
Yeah, Karen Handel.
I mean, what was the issue between the two of them that would make conservatives fall in one camp or the other?
You know, I'll be totally honest with you, I don't know as much about that race. That wasn't one of the ones that I was tracking very seriously.
This is Georgia governor, not Georgia Senate.
Right. I wasn't tracking that one very seriously, so I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not sure. I just know that I think the post on Red State was, you know, it's over. Let's do what we can to support our candidate
together.
Now. Let's all come together. You know, which sometimes you don't always get that. Let's all come together. This is fine sort of post if the person that has won is perceived to be the dreaded rhino. So, you know, I think that's a good sign for Republicans.
Do you think in general, coming out of all these races, where I think the bulk of the commentary has been this was bad for Republicans, are conservative bloggers in general looking at it that way? Or are they, that Georgia governor race was one where I think the more Tea Party-ish, you know, candy. I don't know if either Deal or Handel would be even considered real Tea Partiers, but they certainly have won a number of these races. Are conservative bloggers excited about that fact? Are you having some commentators saying, "I wish we weren't, well, you know, rolling the dice this way"?
In general, a lot of conservative bloggers are very excited that their guy or their woman is winning in these primaries. And you see, you've seen a lot of let's take another example of a race that's coming up. I believe it's in Arizona with Mr. Quayle, but not the Dan Quayle that was vice president, running in a race against a woman named Pamela Gorman, who is viewed as, you know, the conservative choice. And I think that, you know, if somebody like Pamela Gorman pulls it off, there's just going to be another person who was a favorite of the right who manages to pull it off. And I think that if you are ever going to have a year where candidates that are further to the right on the spectrum have a shot, it's this year. So I think that's why you've actually seen a lot of conservative bloggers sort of cheering, like, we got our guy, we got our guy this time. And if there was ever a year when that was going to be good news for the establishment party, it would be this year. I mean, look at Marco Rubio and Charlie Crist down in Florida. That's a race I followed very, very closely because I'm from Florida originally. In that case, you know, you had Marco Rubio running, and at the beginning, the Republican establishment wasn't paying attention, and it was just a lot of, like, excited bloggers getting the word out there. It was the Tea Party movement, and then all of a sudden, you had Marco Rubio blowing Charlie Crist out of the water in these polls and winding up with Charlie Crist leaving the party. And now folks are saying if he wins, he'll caucus with Democrats. So, I think the conservative blogosphere has a lot to celebrate thus far with their record in primaries. They're not winning them all. the other thing that I always think is silly is, turning on the news on a Wednesday morning after a primary night, you always see the pundits talking about, like, well, what does this mean for November? What does this mean for the, you know,
I'm
the
sure
big
still there.
Picture?
I
and I think that, like, little, that statewide primaries are usually based on so many issues that have nothing to do with the national environment. And I'll be the first to say that I think you need a national narrative to drive, you know, a big wave election in Congress. But I always think it's funny to see folks, like, trying to say, well, let's connect the dots between this primary in Georgia and this primary in Colorado and this primary in Connecticut. Let's see, what does it all mean? Because I often think Linda McMahon getting chosen in Connecticut doesn't actually have a lot to do with Ken Buck getting chosen in Colorado, or, you know, I think that there's often way too much read into it by pundits who are trying to, like, fill the hours.
Oh, we're back. Sorry for a little technical hiccup there. Skype connection got dropped, but we can just pick up where we left off. Talking about the elections, one issue that could well be a big issue in the election is immigration, with the Arizona immigration law in judicial limbo, with some conservatives talking about changing the 14th Amendment to end birthright citizenship. And now you have this new study from the Pew Hispanic Center putting a number on how many children are born here from on the undocumented, and I would say probably aspects in that poll could be cited by either side. What was your take on what are conservative bloggers saying?
Well, they're saying that, I mean, if we're in a situation where 8% of children born in the United States are born to undocumented parents, that it just really underscores the need to, you know, increase border security, and it increases the, you know, it really highlights the situation we have in the U.S. where we have all of these folks who are here and they're not supposed to be. And so, you know, there's a big divide on the right. I think I was personally very surprised to see Lindsey Graham coming out in favor of amending the 14th Amendment. But you've seen, I think, that the Pew study has just really shown the sort of gravity of the situation, and is underscoring a need to do something. Now, not necessarily the sort of immigration reform that the Obama administration would like. You saw that the big divide on the right when Bush tried to push forward comprehensive immigration reform back a few years ago. So clearly, I mean, immigration is always a hot button issue with the right. I think I saw one of the most interesting takes on it, though, that is sort of challenging my personal, you know, belief that we should not change the 14th Amendment. It was Raihan Salam at National Review, and then referencing Will Wilkinson, who put up a pretty serious defense of amending birthright citizenship, but not necessarily for the reasons that a Tom Tancredo might support amending birthright citizenship. Instead, it was this idea of decoupling, you know, living and working somewhere with all of the other trappings of citizenship. And Wilkinson's piece references the EU as having a very interesting model that has, you know, liberated labor forces, allowed folks to cross borders to work and to generate, you know, to become prosperous, regardless of the fact that they may have been born in a country that is less prosperous.
Now, just this week, I think today, as we tape this, the Senate has passed a border security bill by unanimous consent. $600 million going to more border agents and aerial drones. This had already cleared the House earlier in the week in their special session. And I think that was also done by a voice vote. Even though I saw some conservatives on the floor complaining about the process which the bill came about, there didn't seem any interest on the Republican side to put any of those no votes on record. Are we seeing, and there's a CQ story today saying the Democrats are looking at this as a way to say, okay, you wanted border security first before we did broader reform. You got it. We're doing the drones. We're doing more agents. Deportations are already up. The left is already mad at Obama that deportations are up, at least some parts of the left. And they're hoping this gives us some credibility to do broader reform after the election. Is there any sense in the conservative blogosphere saying, I'm glad that they passed this bill, I'm glad that they're treating this first, and let's talk about broader reform as the next step, or is there a more of a naysaying, this is not enough, it'll never be enough kind of attitude?
I haven't seen that many posts on it. I mean, again, I think there's a sense that the, you know, it's all well and good, and we absolutely need to step up border security, but there's been discussion that the Obama administration, you know, tried to make this, like, end run around Congress to sort of push their own version of amnesty. And a lot of folks on the right are very supportive of the Arizona law, and so, you know, I don't think the Obama administration is viewed with a great sense of trust in the conservative blogosphere. I don't think that it should be a partisan issue, or that we do the things we need to make sure that our border is secure. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me that Republicans wouldn't have voted no on this bill, even if they're, you know, upset about the way that it was handled.
Now, going back to the issue of children born from the undocumented, there were different liberal takes on that I saw in the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. You had Jamel Bui in Tapped saying you can't draw much conclusion from the Pew numbers. They don't tell us much outside of basic demographic information. We know nothing about the circumstances of these births. That's it. It's still the case that anchor babies aren't really a problem. American-born children of undocumented immigrants must be 21 before they can sponsor a parent for citizenship. And while I'm not going to categorically dismiss the possibility of that kind of long-term planning, I don't think it's unreasonable to say that the overwhelming majority of undocumented parents are not thinking that far ahead. And there was also, I noted in the Times story about the study, that most parents had been in the United States for at least a year, if not 5 years, before having children, and sort of refuted the notion that for scurrying across the border just to, quote-unquote, drop a child and scurrying mm-hmm. and then planting their roots. And Latina Lista took aim at a conservative state rep in Texas who was on CNN peddling a theory that, terrorists are coming into the U.S., having a child in hopes of spawning
That link, and I was like, oh, gosh.
That's not where you are, I take it.
No. I've actually, one of them, and I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on this. There's a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, Hans A. von Spakovsky, who his take in Politico Arena was that folks are actually misrepresenting the real issue when it comes to birthright citizenship, that, in fact, the 14th Amendment, its intent was to ensure that, you know, slaves and their children were offered the benefit of citizenship, and that because the actual wording, it says that all persons born in the U.S. and, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens, sort of making the point, you know, that they're talking about if you have to be the child of someone who is born in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S., you could argue if you're illegal and you're living in the shadows, that therefore you would not be subject to the jurisdiction. So that's an argument coming from the right that that I've seen that is a legal semantic.
That's from arguing for a different interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
Right. The 14th Amendment isn't actually intended that if you are a live birth on American soil, but your parents also have to be, they have to have been supposed to be here due to that subject to the jurisdiction thereof component. So I don't know to what extent that will pick up any steam, but that was something that caught my eye today.
I asked this to Matt last week, and he wasn't sure about this. I just don't understand where the whole 14th Amendment issue, where it originated. It seemed to kind of come out of nowhere in the past couple of weeks.
And I don't know either. I think it came out because, my first time hearing of it was Lindsey Graham, shocking to me.
That seemed to blow it up.
Yeah, that blew it up because, you know, he's not thought of as a darling of the right. You know, he's someone that is often, a subject of derision on many on conservative blogs. He and John McCain are good friends. I mean, so the idea that he would be the point person and the voice of this, it does make it more radical.
Well, I took Graham's comment to be, I'm going to say something very white right wing to pander to certain folks in my state, a proposal which I know will never, ever, ever come to fruition. While not necessarily undercutting, the attempts I've made at compromise in the future to try to position myself as a more credible deal maker from the right. I didn't take it as a real, Graham sort of does this sort of two-step a lot, it seems.
I think that Republicans are making a big, or conservatives rather, are making a big mistake if they really blow this issue up in advance of the elections. Coming back to my mindset as a political strategist, with unemployment where it is, talking about things that are alienating Hispanic voters, the tone with which not just Republicans, not just conservatives, a lot of times the immigration debate on both sides winds up getting overheated rather than being a sort of substantive policy debate about, okay, what can we do to make sure that everybody who's in this country, we know that they're supposed to be here, we know why they're here, and that we have a way of dealing with folks who aren't here. I feel like on the right, we often get into this. It's either we have to deport everyone or anything else is amnesty. And I feel like one of the big problems with Bush's comprehensive immigration bill was the path to citizenship. Then on the right, citizenship is sort of a very, I mean, well, it's not just a sacred thing on the right. It's a sacred thing in America, you know. I mean, there's, I think in, it was Carrie Howley's piece writing about the immigration thing. You know, she made a reference to the U.S. as sort of a club, a club with special membership, and, you know, everybody wants to be in the club, and so, you know, what sorts of laws are you going to have in place to make sure that folks who are benefiting from the club are also contributing to the club?
I was surprised. I raised this question about why this 14th Amendment thing came up out of nowhere, because it seemed to me that conservatives were on a good run with the Arizona law, politically speaking. You know, maybe they weren't on a good run with it, legally speaking. But the polling has generally shown support for the Arizona law. That seemed to be kind of safe ground, and then to go mucking with the Constitution,
We also had Rasmussen. Well, this is a risk because it sort of takes it a step further. But you had a Rasmussen poll show that 58%. Again, that's a Rasmussen poll, so I know a lot of folks say Rasmussen.
I'm not a fan of Rasmussen polls.
I know, but it showed that 58% of folks actually supported amending birthright citizenship. So, I mean, it's a politically charged issue. Although I just worry that conservatives are worried about rallying their base around this. When, you know, Roy Teixeira has written so much fantastic stuff about the sort of demographic realities that are confronting the Republican Party and the Democratic Party that make, you know, the Republican Party, it's more and more difficult for us to put together a majority 10, 15 years down the road, because Hispanics are growing in such a large portion of the electorate, because young voters broke so far away from Republicans in the last few elections. So I always just get very nervous whenever the immigration debate comes up and we take it to places like this where we really are potentially alienating Hispanics. And I don't think Harry Reid did himself any favors with his comment recently where he said, he doesn't understand how any Hispanics could consider themselves Republican. And you had folks like Leslie Sanchez from the right all coming out really condemning these statements. You had Marco Rubio coming out condemning these statements. I'm interested in your take on, you know, within the right, there's a division on the immigration issue. Are there any divisions on the left that you've seen?
Oh, my goodness. There's tons of divisions on the left.
Well, I mean, what are the big, like, blog posts that you've, you know, what are the things you've seen this week?
I don't think there's a lot of division in the blogosphere on the subject. I think the blogosphere is very, you know, pro-immigrant, you know, wants reform, wants pathways to citizenship, highly sensitive to, calling out perceived bigotry, anything that would imply there should be, you know, two tiers of citizenship or you know, two classes of Americans, that sort of thing. But certainly in the broader left, you know, there are plenty of Democratic politicians that are not fully on board with broad reform. It's one of the reasons why, you know, George Bush couldn't do it, even with the support of, you know, with Ted Kennedy and John McCain, and Obama doesn't have a simple coalition to put together now either. Mm-hmm. You have lots of concerns, you know, I think that transcend ideology. To what degree does undocumented workers impact the jobs picture for Americans who are already here? And you can cite studies saying both things, but that certainly makes it difficult to pursue the issue, particularly in a down economy where those sorts of issues clearly have traction. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, of all the areas where the Obama administration has pushed very hard on, immigration is not one of them. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that the right has a problem with keeping a chunk of the Latino vote, you could argue that the loss of the Latino vote was the factor that swung elections to the Democrats in 06 and 08. But you have a concern now, and there was a political story about this, that the Spanish language media has been hammering Obama for not following through on immigration reform. Mm-hmm. And whether or not you think that's a fair shot to put on his shoulders, obviously the bill is not there. So to the degree that the Republican Party is not bringing those voters back by having what's perceived as anti-immigrant rhetoric, that a Latino vote might at least be depressed in 2010, mm-hmm. On top of the general economic concerns that, you know, affect all sectors of America, but hit both Latino and African American voters more. That might allow, you know, that white male anti-immigrant constituency to be spiked in 2010, and it wouldn't harm Republicans at least this year, even if they don't bring Latino voters over. But I think your point is still very valid as far as long-term political concerns. Demographically speaking, the Republican Party can't sustain without getting more Latino voters in there under their umbrella.
Yeah. You know, it's Latino voters and it's young voters. That's a huge pet issue of mine is getting the Republican Party to be to do more outreach to young voters and to be more in line with their values, which sort of leads us right into our next topic, which is all about the discussion about the overturning of California Proposition 8 and Ross Douthat's column in the New York Times.
Yeah, you know, Douthat, I think, is there at the Times to stir discussion, to rile up the generally liberal New York Times readers, and I feel like this is what he hit that mark, where you had, you know, I think in the liberal blog, as far as a general take on Douthat, that he essentially, and I'm sure I'm quoting another blogger, and I'm forgetting who. That said, you know, 80% of the column will be perfectly well reasoned, and it'll just go off on a bender on the last 20%, and where it won't make as much sense. And so he was hit pretty hard by folks like Steve Bennett at the Washington Monthly, quote, still waiting for a coherent argument. So he's basically making this argument that starts off seemingly going after conservative totems on marriage. Look, marriage has not always been the historical norm. Certainly monogamous marriage has not always been an historical norm. Don't treat it like it's always been around because it hasn't. It's a pretty modern concept. Mm-hmm. But then he goes up by the end to say, but there's still something special about heterosexual monogamous marriage, which deserves protection and should be treated uniquely than a same-sex relationship. Steve Bennett says, I see. So two consenting adults who are in love and want to legally commit to one another should be allowed to marry, but only if Ross Douthat considers them to be a, quote, microcosm of civilization and an organic connection between human generations. I keep thinking that given enough time, opponents of marriage equality will come up with a reasonable argument or two that just hasn't happened yet. Amanda Marcotte at Pandagon basically says, aha, so Douthat will admit there's such a thing as patriarchy that opposes the idea of equality between the sexes. But he claims that Jewish and Christian tradition holds that women are equal to men, something many people actually state the Bible will be surprised to discover. She goes on to say, marriage is according to that a rejection of patriarchy that doesn't exist except when he says it does. And the equality of the sexes is best upheld by discriminating on the basis of gender when it comes to who can get married. So it's that kind of argumentation, which is getting Douthat a lot of flack from the left. There's other folks on the right that seem to be, whether they agree with Douthat or not, seem much more interesting to engage his argumentation and not dismiss it so bluntly.
Yeah, I think that one of the reasons why I feel like critics from the right who disagree with his general point, a great one is from at the American Scene, Pascal Emmanuel Gobry. He says, you know, that. He references Andrew Sullivan, whose piece is basically, you know, yes, you know, a heterosexual marriage, you know, as a moral ideal, great. The quote here is, you know, that while he extols, that while the ideal Ross extols might be wonderful as a religious or even a moral ideal, it does not necessarily follow that the law should promote it at the exclusion of everything else. And that even if that were the fact, the fact of countless homosexuals' unions exists, unions that are worth something, and that denying them the legal protections of marriage is a very heavy, to the point of being inhumane, price to pay for a theoretical protection of another kind of ideal. It's not saying that Ross... I always get skeptical when I see bloggers who point to something like Ross's column and say, you know, you're homophobic, or... You know, I think that they're... That the place where Ross is coming from is, you know, he's very focused on... You know, in society, you know, a stable heterosexual marriage as an ideal, you know, it can have very positive societal benefits. And so we, you know, the whole thesis of Ross and Reihan's book, Grand New Party, was, you know, that there is a place for fresh thinking that sort of merges social conservative ideals with economic policy to encourage, you know, pro-family policies. But I think that, you know, the point made by Andrew Sullivan is very important, which is... That, you know, just because a couple is heterosexual, they're allowed to get married even if they're not going to produce children. You know, they're allowed to divorce. They're allowed, you know, we can have Britney Spears going to Vegas. You know, I mean, that, these are arguments we've heard before, but Andrew's piece is just, it's really touching, actually. It's includes photos of his family, you know, from in his relationship. It's a really beautiful piece, and I think it was a very restrained intellectual response to Ross's column, which I thought was a very I thought was a good way of framing the conservative argument for why the traditional family, quote unquote, should retain special protections. I definitely side more personally with the Andrew Sullivan argument on this one, but I do think that Ross's column did successfully try to sort of find that fine bit of common ground by rejecting more commonly used conservative arguments for opposing same-sex marriage.
It seems like there is some, you know, intra-ideology dialogue going on in the conservative movement on this subject. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be going beyond that to conservative politicians. I haven't seen a conservative elected official, you know, praise the Prop 8, you know, judicial ruling this week, for example.
It's interesting to note as well, however, I mean, Barack Obama, you know, in the debates, when he said, "I do not support same-sex marriage," I mean, I was sort of taken aback. I wasn't necessarily expecting him to go there
many liberal bloggers on.
I would assume that
who are not happy with the president's stance on the subject.
Yeah.
And he got knocked on it during the primary, during the campaign. It's one of the reasons why, if you look at the progressive gay blogosphere, there has never been any intrinsic sense of trust with the president on gay rights issues. You know, the president has generally sort of taken a, you know, be patient, we're working on this stuff, we'll do don't ask, don't tell, we'll do other things, we're moving in a good direction. You don't need to, you know, be upset with us. And a lot of the gay blogosphere has said, you know, I'll believe it when I see it, and I'm going to ride you until, you know, I actually see the goods. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why that's the case is that he has not been, you know, on the you know, cutting edge when it comes to, you know, even if the polls had said, you know, gay marriage is not embraced by the public, they're looking to Obama to be a leader on the subject. Now you actually have a poll from CNN saying that the majority does believe in gay marriage for the first time. It's really an interesting thing to see if there will be a point where, I mean, you could argue that the Democratic Party in general was sort of in the, you know, mushy middle of America on the subject, generally for equality, but not willing to take it as far as marriage. Mm-hmm. And if the public is starting to shift more on that, when can the president and other Democrats actually start pivoting and make a, you know, intellectually coherent argument that if you're for equality, you're for equality. If you're for equality, it extends the marriage rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that is highlighted by the fact that we have a Democratic president who, you know, opposes same-sex marriage, and yet you have, you know, Meghan McCain, who is a young Republican. I think it's almost more generational than it is necessarily a partisan divide. Especially at the level of, you know, folks who are in office. And, you know, a lot of the tweets I saw surrounding the release of the poll showing that, you know, same-sex marriage has been gaining speed is that, you know, just as younger folks become older folks, as older folks pass away or leave the political process, it's sort of a tide shifting generationally rather than, you know, ideologically emanating from the left and encroaching on the right.
Back in after our second technical glitch, let's move right along to our final subject, also election-related, potentially at least. Congressman Charlie Rangel, who has been charged with ethical violations of House rules, in the middle of the special House session to pass emergency state aid, where Democrats were all excited to be able to say, we have come to the rescue of teachers on the verge of being laid off, and firefighters and police officers, and governors that need help with Medicaid funding. Charlie Rangel steps in, using a parliamentary point of procedure, a point of personal privilege, which allows you to go to the floor to defend your honor, if I understand correctly. Goes off for over 30 minutes, openly saying against the advice of his lawyers and his friends, and at this giant, you know, pity party, saying, "Hey, we're here for teachers and firefighters. What about me? What about my dignity? Why is the ethics committee speeding up the procedure? You're gonna dare to expel me when I helped all you guys get elected?" I know from one of my blogging head sessions I did with Con Carroll from the Heritage Foundation, I think over a year ago. I mean, he was practically giddy at the prospect of Charlie Rangel being ousted from the Ways and Means Committee, where I think most folks on the left, myself included, were kind of like, whatever. And if he did something wrong, we're kind of like, fine, did something wrong, get rid of him. Who cares? Now coming towards the election day, are conservative bloggers looking at Charlie Rangel and saying, this guy gave us a huge opening to hold up the Democratic Party as a morass of ethical dubiousness?
You're seeing a little bit of that, although I think for many folks it's just like, it's the combination of the Rangel and the Waters thing. I mean, it's just sort of this, look, Pelosi said she was going to drain the swamp, and, you know, it's been 4 years, and just now, I mean, Charlie Rangel's not new to Congress. This isn't all necessarily new stuff. I think the one interesting comparison that I've seen that I don't think will... I don't think is necessarily relevant that I've seen pop up is this going to benefit us the way that the Mark Foley thing benefited Democrats in 2006? That's like the one discussion that I've seen pop up. I don't think it will. I mean, I also disagree that the Mark Foley thing had a huge hand in the Republican implosion in 2006. But that's been like the lens through which I've seen it viewed, rather than yes, it's going to open a political opportunity for Republicans, I think, but overall, I don't know that Charlie Rangel was necessarily helping himself with this big, long statement. One of the links that I think we both sent it to each other actually was Mark Amador at The Atlantic, what was Rangel doing piece. I get it if, you know, you're older, you're in Congress, and you want to leave a good legacy, and so you give this long speech defending yourself. But truth be told, if I were a Democrat, I'd be really nervous about the fact that he's now given 37 minutes of videotape to anyone who wants to make an ad portraying Democrats as corrupt.
Well, it just, bizarre to me that you've been in Congress for 40 years. You know how politics works. You know how things get portrayed in the media. You would think he would be savvy enough to know, as much as he might want to say these things, that it was not going to do himself any good to... I mean, anytime you're saying, what about me? Mm-hmm. And you're talking in terms of yourself and not of your district or your state or your country, that's a pretty bad place for a politician to be in.
Yeah, especially in this sort of year that is so anti-incumbent. But the one thing that... I won't say the one thing that Charlie Rangel is going for him, but the one thing that will... insulate Democrats from the charge that they are all corrupt is the fact that Americans don't believe that all the Republicans are a bunch of saints either. I think it was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that came out today. I believe this was the poll that I saw the number from. But it showed that, you know, Americans, they don't like the Democratic Party, but they're not keen on the Republican Party either. That it's just Americans are not happy with either side. I think it was Mark Murray at NBC who said, this is quoting pollster Peter Hart, that this is like a JetBlue electorate. They're all screaming and running for the emergency slide, that they're just ticked off and they're not taking it anymore, so they're going to take their beers and slide away home.
This is always a frustration on the left when all the Tom DeLay stuff was happening, because the left would be saying, look, there's this systematic corruption at the heart of the Republican Party, and you'd get a lot of, well, they all do it. And you try to say, well, but this is different because this is at the top of the Republican Party, and the whole legislative process is meshed with lobbyists, and you just get all they all do it. And you could never really make a strong case that this was unique. And I imagine that the Republicans would have the same difficult time now.
Yeah, there's like, Gallup does this sort of traditional track. They track a few things. One, they track congressional job approval, which is, I believe, at 19% now. And it's just like a historic low. It was at 39% in like April 2009, and has just been, you know, plummeting since then. They also have something where they ask about trust in institutions, and trust in government is really low. I mean, I actually almost don't think that this Rangel thing will have a big impact, just because I feel like a lot of voters are going to kind of roll their eyes and go, like, yeah, another corrupt congressman.
Well, it certainly, it at least stepped on the narrative of the day for Democrats. They couldn't talk about teachers as easily as they would have liked.
Yeah.
And Jackie Schechner over at America Blog, used to be at CNN, said several times that MSNBC anchors and reporters have asked whether Charlie Rangel's comments on the floor will take away from the coverage of the jobs bill. I don't know, NBC reporters and anchors, will it? How about this? Not if you don't like
it. I read that and I thought, that is so emblematic of the ridiculous.
you could, as a news editor, judge. I think Charlie Rangel's speech is more newsworthy than 150,000 teachers averting being laid off.
Mm-hmm.
But it is your choice as a news editor to make that judgment. It's not some random musing. You think that someone else is going to do it.
As someone on the right, there's a piece that was written by Connor Friedersdorf, like, and this isn't this week in Blog, this is like this decade in Blog. This was like 2 or 3 years ago, but I've loved the piece, and it was the premise. I think it was in Doublethink magazine, or the premise of it anyhow was that conservatives have it worse off because stories that are showing the successes of conservative policies or conservative economic policies are not as sexy as stories touting when liberal economic policies, you know, do things like save teachers' jobs in this case. His example was about rent control and how it's easy for a reporter to find a story about, you know, a woman who wasn't able to find affordable housing and now there's this building where she's able to find affordable housing and isn't that wonderful? Whereas the conservative argument, you know, would be, well, that's not encouraging folks to develop. There's no news story that gets written about the apartment building that was never built because the developer didn't think the incentives were right. So that's, you know, what is newsworthy and what isn't newsworthy, I would say. It's one of the things that is tough for folks on the right is a lot of times, you know, things like deficit reduction were not terribly catchy until very recently. And now you've actually, in that piece you sent me, is, I believe it was the author was saying that she was frustrated because it's the Democrats in the Obama administration have now caught this deficit reduction fever as well because it's sort of the tide of the moment.
Well, that's a whole other subject.
Yeah, sorry.
Which I would love to talk about.
Didn't mean to bring that one up toward the end.
That's okay. But we probably should talk about that if we get to do this in the future because that deficit commission is scheduled to have the recommendations in December. There are a lot of folks on the left, my group, Campaign for America's Future in particular, who are organizing to prevent there from being drastic spending cuts, certainly during a weak economy, don't want Social Security and Medicare on the chopping block. And Democrats are a little bit caught because they see an opening to hit John Boehner for wanting to raise the retirement age to 70. But Steny Hoyer, who's the House Majority Leader, mused that the retirement age could go up to 69. Now, Pelosi doesn't seem to share that view. I don't think most Democrats in the House share that view, but some do. And it makes the messaging a little bit more complicated. But there was a poll that we just put out today with Democracy Corps, which you can see at ourfuture.org, showing that across the spectrum, Democrat, Independent, Republican voters do not want Social Security and Medicare being used for deficit reduction purposes. So this might have a lot of currency in the elections if those who have made those comments could be vulnerable, and it could be an issue after the elections depending on what the White House Deficit Commission decides to do.
We'll have to wait and see.
But it's great talking to you. Glad you could do the show.
Oh, this was great. For my first time, I enjoyed it quite a lot, and now I feel like I know much more about the internal workings of the left. So.
For better or for worse. tell the folks again where they can find your stuff.
Kristen Soltis. So you can go to kristensoltis.com or winstongroup.net, and that's where you'll find sort of the link to the podcast that I do as well as any other stuff that I write.
Excellent. Thanks again, and that'll do it for this week in Blog. We'll catch you next week.